The Guardian Football Weekly, sponsored by PES 2012, released October 14th for PS3 and Xbox 360.
In today's pod, Mancini's reserves run riot at Wolves. We ask, are City now both the top two teams in the Premier League? Elsewhere, can Man United bounce back this weekend at Everton? And will Chelsea leave Arsenal black and blue? Sorry, that's blind and blue. There's Carling Cup in the Championship. Ericsson mobile again. Serie A, Sid in Spain. Plus tweets, posts and more in this Football Weekly Extra. I just think we only went out for an ironing board. Hello, everybody. Hello, Barry Glendenning, specifically.
Boo.
But who are you booing, Barry?
Whoever.
All right, then. And why? Why John Ashton?
Why, indeed, yeah. What's the point? That's not going to help us, is it?
It's not, is it? It's not. Hi, Paul Doyle.
Hi, James.
It's been a while since you've graced our bijou podette.
Indeed.
Been keeping well?
Yeah, and you?
Yeah, looking well in a kind of two-piece knitwear combination. It's a bit of a difference.
I left my pipe outside.
Right. No, I have to say, I mean, in the early days, you know, when the pod was still a steam-driven operation, Paul used to turn up in very, very exotic African-style shirts, didn't you?
I might have done once.
Yeah. Excellent. Anyway, well, it's been an interesting week. There's been the Carling Cup, of course. There's some big games coming up in the Premier League, much to discuss as ever. A lot of it seems to centre on this team, Manchester City, who once again have piled on the goals. This time, Wolves were the victims. Wolves took a 1-0 lead, but then City happened all over them.
Yeah, I did the minute-by-minute on it last night. And it was a strange game, really, because Wolves were quite good for the first half hour, deserved to be ahead. And then City didn't just change gears. I said in the minute-by-minute, they seemed to sort of change species and become this weird sort of footballing predator that destroyed and consumed teams. And they scored three goals in the space of about 5 minutes and could have scored another one before half-time. Then sort of took their foot off the pedal and ended up 5-2. But yeah, they were very impressive once again.
In fairness, Swansea did pretty much the same thing to Wolves at the weekend, except they didn't finish all the chances that they created, but they did cut them apart with similar regularity until the booze inspired the late comeback.
Right, right. Yeah, well done, the crowd there at the Molyneux. Barry, you were asking the question, where would... Because it was an entirely different starting 11, was it, to the starting 11 from the weekend?
New players,
for Man City. Yeah. And where would that team finish in the Premier League, were it to be also in competition?
Well, it's a hypothetical question, obviously, but we can only surmise that they would probably be fifth, sixth. It's the Manchester City, very much a second string side, was still worth £100 million.
Yeah, I have to say, I think it would be up there in the Champions League positions myself.
Well, they did. I mean, they had a couple of youngsters who, Abdul Razak, who I think is 17, played in defensive midfield, and Scappucci, who sort of scored the fourth goal, played out wide on the left. And I think they were okay. They weren't brilliant. They looked a little bit raw still. Although the lad that came on, Denis Suarez, came on for the last sort of 15 minutes and played one absolutely stunning pass, defence splitting, pinpoint with the outside of his boot. And City signed him from Celta Vigo in the summer, from under the noses of Barcelona, apparently. He looked like a, even in that cameo, just one of those sort of eye-opening moments where he looked like a proper talent.
Denis Suarez.
One to watch.
All right, then. Plenty of other Man City stories. Of course, there was Balotelli's ill-fated trip to get the ironing board, which I think we can all appreciate that. I think he's kind of living the dream, isn't he?
Well, he's officially arrived now because that TV company in Taiwan have made the cartoon of his fireworks escapade.
Ah.
And I saw him, I was assembling our classic YouTube feature today, and that's in it. And there's also a Q&A he did for the Manchester City website on Monday. And yeah, he just seems like a really, really nice guy. Apparently, he spent a lot of Monday driving around Manchester in an open-top Bentley, just high-fiving anyone he had to go. So, I mean, he just seems like he's a real breath of fresh air, a good player and a lovely guy, if not a bit bonkers.
But. All right. And that's what we've always said here on this pod.
Sadly, it was put to him. He was answering questions from people on Twitter, and someone said, is it true you're organising the Christmas party? And he looked a bit bewildered. And he said to whoever was, you know, with him, his handler, what are they talking about? And they said, oh, they mean the player's Christmas party. And he said, it's not him. So that's rather unfortunate.
Indeed so. Less happy, of course, Carlos Tevez, who's been fined £1 million or 4 weeks' wages by Man City, and he's responded that he may sue Mancini for suggesting that he refused to play when he actually refused to warm up, or some similar injustice. Interesting. A lot of people were making the point that Kier Jarabchian has now managed to make both his chief clients completely unemployable. Both Tevez, who looks set for a long spell on the sidelines because City apparently aren't going to accept any cut price offers, and also Mark Hughes, who was the subject of an extraordinary outburst by Mohamed Al-Fayed. I know this was a while ago, but Al-Fayed basically used the Fulham website to write what a strange man Mark Hughes is. Mark Hughes had said, well, Fulham are a bit unambitious, that's why I left. He said he was sat by Manchester City. This is Al-Fayed's take on Mark Hughes. Sat by Manchester City, he was becoming a forgotten man when I rescued him to become manager of Fulham Football Club. He fully negotiated a 2-year extension to his contract on the day he was due to sign. He walked out without the courtesy of a proper explanation. Now he insults the club, saying it lacks ambition and the players who delivered an 8th position finish last season and a place in the Europa League. He's not just disrespectful, but entirely wrong. There you go. Another man that I'm beginning to warm to.
Well, if you're being belittled by Mohamed Al-Fayed, yeah, and he appears to have a point, yeah, you're not in a good place.
Mohamed Al-Fayed is the best owner in the Premier League, I think. But
why, Paul?
Because he's been absolutely brilliant for Fulham, and he's top entertainment as well.
Right, okay, the statue, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. That's what you want. You want more statues of musical pioneers.
But you're suggesting that with a kind of a comparative to his means, he's actually invested a huge amount and has given his managers a lot of support, that kind of thing, do you think?
He has, yeah. And he's, in most cases, made good managerial appointments. Laurie Sanchez didn't quite work out, but other than that, they've been very astute appointments.
Yeah.
And he's done well. And they've been not only astute appointments, but unexpected appointments in a lot of cases. He's not the sort of guy who just goes for, you know, the manager who's hanging around the corner.
Mm.
And Mark Hughes, it was a grim mistake to walk out on them. But even when he walked in, he made it clear that he felt he was too good for Fulham. He kept on talking about how lucky Fulham are to have him. And you, right from the outset, you got the impression that he wouldn't be there for very long.
Interesting, yeah.
But I think it speaks volumes for Mohamed Al-Fayed's tenure at Fulham that the one thing he's done, possibly the only thing he's done that I can think of to really upset fans, is put up a statue
of Michael Jackson.
Yeah. So, you know, yeah, if that's as bad as it gets.
Man City are playing Wolves again this weekend. That'll be tight, I thought, ironically. But then I remembered that in actual fact, it was last time. They met at the Etihad Stadium back in January, and it was 4-3. A narrow victory for Man City, and very little has changed since then, of course.
Well, City are scoring an average of 3 goals a game. Wolves' defence is pretty awful.
They got a point last weekend.
They did, yes. And it's difficult to see Wolves getting anything from this game. They're 17-1 with the bookies to win it. But I just noticed today I've been getting a bit of stick from Wolves fans on the blog for castigating them for booing Mick McCarthy. Wolves have actually 2 points more this season than they had this time last year.
Really?
Yeah, so.
And it's probably fair to point out that last night Wolves made 9 changes from the weekend as well, so it wasn't exactly a Wolves first choice 11. They had a young kid at right back who had a bit of a nightmare time against Kolarov. But yeah, at some point somebody will work out how to play against City and stop them from being quite so dominant, but I don't think that'll be this weekend.
Usually when people work out a way to play against a team, it's because they have a way of playing, but Man City seem to have a variety of ways they can approach a game, and indeed any opponent. Still, there you go. That's that game. Man United, meanwhile, who singularly failed to stop Man City last weekend, are going to be at Everton. Popular opinion has it that this is a tough place for them to go in a fixture they don't enjoy. Also, of course, Royston Drinthe, now the big story at Goodison Park. A fantastic goal from him, and all round a massive performance by the crazed Dutch loon figure.
But he's now suspended because he got sent off.
No.
Yes.
No Royston Drenthe.
No Royston Drenthe.
Curses. All right. Well, there you go.
He'll be focusing on his hip-hop career.
Right. Yeah. All right. Well, that's the silver lining.
You'd imagine Everton will have a lot of chances to score against United, because everyone has had a lot of chances to score against United this season, because they've had defensive problems, partially because of the injuries to Vidic and Ferdinand, and partially because of Johnny Evans and other factors. But the question is, will Everton take those chances? Because that has been a persistent failing of them in recent times, the inability to convert all their chances into goals. But Louis Saham is fit as we speak, and may still be fit by Saturday. And United, another reason why they haven't, it's one win in four in the league. Another factor in that has been there is still that lack of creativity in midfield. Tom Cleverty looked to have provided a solution to that earlier in the season, but he, of course, then got injured. And they have like Hernandez has been in and out of the side through injury as well. So they're not yet firing on all cylinders. And
although they also had a bit of a run out for the reserves on in the Carling Cup, and an impressive there from Berbatov and Owen and the like. Valencia 3-0 win over Aldershot.
I know some of Fleet Street's finest have been clamouring for Michael Owen to be included in the England squad on the back of his goal against Aldershot.
Hmm.
And I noticed, I think it was Jimmy Ward scored 3 against Aldershot for Chesterfield in 2008, so that makes him 3 times as good as Michael Owen. But he's already been capped by Northern Ireland, so he won't make it into the England squad.
All right then. Everton, meanwhile, coming off an extra-time defeat to Chelsea.
Yeah, and they have already lost to City, Liverpool and Chelsea in the league.
Ooh.
And last night they lost Tim Cahill and Phil Neville to injury, so they're both doubts for the weekend.
Oh dear, that doesn't look very good, does it? Let's talk about Chelsea then, who are hosting Arsenal in possibly the marquee fixture of this weekend in the Premier League. Well, Arsenal beat them 3-1 at the Emirates last season, but then lost 2-0 last time they visited Stamford Bridge. Arsenal, as we mentioned on Monday, have now won 7 of their last 8. At the time it was 6 of the last 7, but they've gone and won since then against Bolton. And Vermaelen might be back.
He almost certainly will be back, which is good for Arsenal, but their away record is not good. They concede a lot of goals, as many as anyone else in the Premier League. Joint worst. They've conceded 14 in 4 away games, and Chelsea have won 10 and drawn 1 of their last 11. But I think if Arsenal could win this game or even get a draw, they would really get their season back on the rails. Their AGM is actually today being Thursday. So Stan Kroenke, their mysterious mustachioed American owner, is expected to speak for the first time ever as owner. He'll probably say something along the lines that we will continue to run this club as a, you know, financially solid, good concern with and continue to act as a feeder club for Manchester City.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what Arsenal fans will want to hear.
It's an interesting game because there's no Drogba, no Bissouma after their disciplinary nightmare at Loftus Road last weekend. But Fernando Torres is back.
Yeah, but it's weird, isn't it? Because Drogba's been kind of Arsenal's bogeyman for the past few seasons. His record is something like 14 in 14 games. I'm not entirely sure about the exact stat, but it's along those lines. Yeah, I mean, if Arsenal win, they're only 3 points behind Chelsea, which is amazing considering the start that Arsenal have had. And, you know, it's weird as well because you sort of... They're sort of teams aiming at slightly different things now. I mean, Chelsea have presumably still got their eyes on the title, where Arsenal would be, you know, happy, and Arsene Wenger said he'd be happy with a top four finish. So it's a slightly different type of Arsenal-Chelsea fixture this year.
I'd like to see Arsenal star Andre Arshavin in a central role. He played there on Tuesday night against Bolton in the Carling Cup, and it was his best performance for a long time for Arsenal. And, of course, he regularly plays there for Russia, whereas performances have contrasted with his rather glum club form over the last while. So he doesn't particularly like being stationed out wide. If he was to play in a central role, and you've got Walcott and Gervinho, for example, out wide, and drop Arteta back a little bit, because he has the passing repertoire to supply all those guys, he doesn't have the dynamism, though, that Fabregas, for instance, had just behind the front man. And Arshavin is more dynamic. I know he gets criticised for not trying, apparently. I think that's slightly unfair. Well, he doesn't try defensively, it must be said, but which is another reason to put him just behind a striker.
Hmm.
So I'd like to see that.
Yeah, all right. And you have who on the wings, sorry, Alex?
Well, Walcott and not Oxlade-Chamberlain, no. Because I think he showed in midweek, although he obviously has enormous potential, that he still has a lot to learn. But
right.
Himself and Frimpong lost the ball a lot of times in possession, and that's one thing you can't do at Arsenal.
All right. Signs of them turning the corner?
Slowly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, good.
If Vermaelen comes back in, presumably, does that mean Koscielny will lose his place, or will he go to fullback? And
I'm glad
Giroud
you asked me that, Barry.
Will lose his place. I'm looking at you, James Richardson. What do you think? Tell me.
I think he'll lose his place.
Who?
Koscielny.
No, I doubt.
Koscielny gets a hard time. He's a very good defender.
Well,
I think Giroud loses his place.
All right,
like
then
a shot.
That'll be you. Yeah. The juror will be out in a very real sense. Yeah. Okay, that's it for part one. Coming up next, Sid and other stuff too in part two. Right, part two, and on the line, Sid Lowe, who's very much in Madrid. Sid.
Hello, James, how are you?
I'm well, and how are you, Sid?
Not too bad, thank you.
Great. Hey, Sid, adelante, levante.
Absolutely brilliant, isn't it? I must confess, I didn't see the game because I was doing a Madrid doubleheader last night. I went to Rayo Vallecano and then went from there to Real Madrid and had to leave the Rayo game early. I was on the metro when I got a message on the phone saying that Real Sociedad had scored in the 85th minute to deny Levante the victory. I don't believe it. What a pity. What a great story. Maybe it's just about to come to an end. And then my phone died, and I got to the Bernabeu and was watching the first half of the Real Madrid game. And at half-time said to a colleague, what a pity, eh? Levante getting that late equaliser, which means they didn't win this week. And he said, what are you talking about? They scored in the 93rd minute. And I surprised myself by how pleased I was about it. It's just a fantastic story, and it keeps on going on.
Well, it certainly does. So how many wins in a row is that now?
I think I'm right in saying that's seven in a row. It's nine games this year, seven wins, two draws. And I think I'm right in saying that the two draws were the first two. So all seven wins are in a row, I think.
Right. Amazing, isn't it? Three goals by them, six cards they picked up. By now, we should be learning some of their names. Who are the players that we should be kind of throwing at the listeners?
Well, this is one of the things that I love about them. The player that's the real hero, and this in a way kind of sums them up, is the club captain, a guy called Sergio Ballesteros. And he's 36, and he's the heaviest player in La Liga. And you look at him and he wears his T-shirt baggy, and even then you can see that frankly, he's a bit heavy for a footballer. He's a bit big, but he's incredibly quick. And he's the big star. And this, as I say, this is the guy that, in a way, kind of embodies everything that Levante are about. This is a guy, as I say, he's 36, he's big, he's heavy, he doesn't look like a footballer. I've spoken to him a couple of times, and he has the thickest neck I've ever seen in my life.
What position does he play?
He's a centre-back.
Oh, okay.
And brilliantly, there was a moment earlier this season where he out-sprinted Cristiano Ronaldo. You know, and this was just at the time when most people were going, oh, he's that fat old slow bloke at the back. And he's the guy who more than 30% of the shirts in the club shop are his. They're holding up banners of him now as if he was the Ayatollah almost. There's a big chant that goes around the Levante Stadium, Ballesteros Selección, in other words, call him up to the national team. And actually, you know what? It wouldn't be that ridiculous, given Spain's problems at centre-back, if he was called up to the national team. He is the kind of the anti-hero turned proper hero that I think kind of helps to embody everything that the Levante story is all about.
Wow, great stuff. There you go. So they're still top of the league. Now, what else we got? Madrid astonishing, but crisis in Catalonia, is that right?
Yeah, Madrid were brilliant last night, certainly for the first half an hour. And obviously, as I mentioned earlier, I came sprinting up to the Real Madrid ground from Rayo Vallecano. I walked into the stadium 12 minutes into the game to hear the roar of the second goal. So I missed two of the three goals, which is a bit of a pity. Madrid are rubbish, though, James, because they only got three last night, which is their worst victory of the season, because they've always scored six or four until now. But they were very, very good indeed, really quick. The precision in the passing was excellent. Whereas Barcelona won 1-0 against Granada with a free kick from Xavi. It really was a poor game. They were flat, they were slow. So much so that there's discussions now about, well, what's wrong with Leo Messi, who still hasn't scored away from home, I think I'm right in saying, in La Liga. He missed a couple of good chances, one of which where he dinked it over the goal. And you think, well, if he just kicked the ball properly, it would go in. It was cleared off the line because he dinked it over the keeper. I don't think it's a crisis by any means, but certainly they're not looking quite right, Barcelona. I think they're doing certain things really badly wrong. I think the lack of pace about the way they're moving the ball around is concerning. I think there's one or two little things that Guardiola's not happy about behind the scenes as well.
Well, there you go. Sid, thank you very much for that brief little update. And big games this weekend?
Yeah, there's a couple tonight before we even get to this weekend. Espanyol Betis and Athletic Bilbao against Atletico Madrid. And that's where there might be some news, because Atletico Madrid's coach, Gregorio Manzano, is under big, big pressure. Yeah. And if he was to get sacked, which, let's face it, wouldn't be unusual for Atletico Madrid, we might see the return of Luis Aragonés.
All right.
At the very least, will be entertaining.
All right. Or Sven. That's what I'm throwing out there. Right.
Well, is Sven looking for another sacking?
Well, done him pretty well so far.
I think he's the only manager
in
the world, isn't he, Sven, that goes into a job wondering when he gets sacked and how that'll work out for him.
Yeah, pretty well, generally, yeah. Excellent. Thank you very much, Sid. Look forward to hearing more about that on Monday.
Brilliant. Speak to you then.
Thanks, Sid.
Cheerio.
Excellent. Full round of fixtures in Italy. Well, but I don't know if anyone saw the Napoli-Udinese game. if they did. 2-0 win by Napoli, ending Udinese's unbeaten run. First goal, absolute cracker. Did you go and look at that, Barry, did you?
No.
Listeners, don't make Barry's mistake. Go and check this goal out, because it's an absolute peach. There's a ball in, Cavani tries to control it, bad first touch, but his second one, he basically taps out and volleys it over his head to the sort of edge of the penalty box where Lovetzi's running in, and he absolutely hammers it, volleys it into the far top far corner, and it's a brilliant goal. Anyway, that means that Juventus, with their win over Fiorentina, have gone top, and it's all very very tight at the top in Italy. Five teams within 3 points, Juve, Lazio and Udinese, then Napoli and Milan. Milan are going to be playing Roma this weekend. That's a huge game. Roma dominated at the Marassi against Genoa, but lost. Milan beat Parma 4-1 with another hat-trick from a midfielder. This time, bizarrely, it was Nocerino. Inter, meanwhile, are far, far away from those leading teams. They're all the way down in 16th place. They're 7 points off the top three, which is Champions League these days in Serie A. And they, this weekend, are going to be taking on Juventus. Ooh.
I just noticed in the Serie A table, of the bottom five teams, four of them are 1,500 to one or more to win the title, and Inter are 8-1.
Yeah, it's interesting. You fancy that, do you?
No.
There are only seven off the top three, which means they're only 8 points off the top. Yep. In the crazy world of Serie A, in the topsy-turvy world of Calcio, stranger things have happened.
Oh, that's strange. We know that.
Chuckle.
Who is going to win the Serie A this year then?
James? I don't know. I mean, Juve, top of the table. They're looking good. They are looking good, actually. They're passing the ball around nicely. Matri's looking good. I didn't think he was all that when he went. I mean, he was good at a small club, but I didn't think he was going to be big enough for Juve. But he's playing really well for them, and much more effective than Vucinic, actually, at the moment. But anyway, yeah, I'd say they look good.
Not Napoli?
Oh, actually, yeah, you're right. I should say Napoli, shouldn't I? I mean, they could do. I don't know. Don't ask this question. Anyway, the beloved aunt says, Juve Fiorentina was rather a good match. AC Jimbo, did you ever give us an answer on your footballing man crush? It's just that I have a pack of Tunnock's tea cakes riding on it being Gigi Buffon. But no, it wasn't Gigi Buffon, so tough luck, beloved aunt. Gigi Casiraghi, every day of the week. Oh, those sweet doe eyes and those perfect chiseled cheekbones. He also adds, as for pizza in Rome, daremo in testaccio, knocks the rest into a cocked hat, says the beloved aunt. My word, this pizza in Rome business, that's going to run and run. Good, anyway, now, John Ashdown, championship correspondent, there's been more Sven Hassel.
Yeah. Sven Hassel.
Yeah.
The Bloody Road to Hell. Classic, classic book.
Sven Göran Eriksson. He's out again.
Yeah, the Svenolution is over after 13 games of the season and I think 387 days in the job. Darius Henderson's hat-trick for Millwall at the weekend. He became the first visiting player to score a hat-trick at the Walker Stadium since Ruud van Nistelrooy. And that was enough for the owners. And he's out on his backside once more.
Mm. I suspect there's a certain amount of financial cushioning underneath that.
Yeah, his fall was his backside nicely cushioned by great big wads of notes.
Right, okay.
Although it was a mutual consent.
Oh, really?
Departure.
So it may not have been a...
So I don't know quite how that might affect things.
Wads of notes wouldn't really cushion your fall, though.
Not if they were too tightly bound.
Yeah, you need just a general pile of notes.
Well, you must have learned how to arrange them by now.
Well, I remember, Jonathan Wilson described Sven as a money sponge, which I think just was perfect. What a life he has, going from job to job, getting sacked, getting a huge payout, and then moving on to the next.
Am I right in saying, though, that he didn't do that bad a job at Leicester?
He was fine last season, but they've been really inconsistent this year. They've beaten Southampton, who are top, Brighton, when they were top, and Derby. They hammered Derby 4-0 when Derby was sort of second, third. But then they've lost at home to Reading, to Bristol City, and just the fact they've spent a lot of money in the summer, I think something around £10 million on transfer fees alone over the summer, means that...
Doesn't sound a lot, but is that a lot in
the Championship? That's a huge amount, yeah. Okay. And to be 13th, even at this early stage of the season, clearly wasn't good enough. I mean, the Championship is a strange sort of division in that way. There's been seven managerial departures, I think, in the whole of the 92 clubs so far this season, and five of those has been in the Championship.
Oh, right.
I think it's because teams go into the season, so many teams go in there with legitimate designs on going up, you know, and justifiable designs of going up. And so when things start going slightly badly wrong, then their managers are more vulnerable.
All right, I understand. And who will be the next there at the...
Well, it won't be Martin O'Neill, who I think could have probably had the job had he wanted it. He's thought about it and decided he doesn't want to go back, never go back. So the bookies' favourite at the moment is Lee Clark, the Huddersfield manager, but he's more or less ruled himself out.
Hmm.
Simon Grayson, the Leeds manager, has ruled himself out. So it's the usual candidates, really. Mark Hughes,
has Stuart
Billy
Pearce ruled himself out? Yeah,
not heard that one. No,
Steve McLaren.
Steve McLaren, he's about sort of 14 and things. I think they're more likely to go to sort of a big name. I don't think these owners are kind of want an up and comer.
Right.
Say a Carl Robinson or whatever. Rafa Benitez is as short as 8-1 with one bookmaker.
Really?
Yeah. Gianfranco Zola's up there.
No way.
Ancelotti, I think you can get 14s on. So.
Right. Good. Couple of posts. Big White and Fluffy says, I'd love to hear the pod's predictions for North America's big rivalry match coming up on Saturday, the marshmallow game. Basically, the two teams and the fans, they throw marshmallows at each other. Racism. Ben Buff says, surely in this day and age, the technology must exist to tell whether a player is racist or not. Excellent post, this. He says, I say we should use the technology they use in cricket and rugby where microphones can prove whether the ball hit the wicket, etc. He basically says, mic everybody up and then get Darren Brown into judgment whether racist thoughts have crossed players' minds. Yeah, all very good. Monty Malachi says, any chance the pod might be able to ask Fernando Duarte whether the Brazilian sports minister resigning for corruption will harm World Cup 2014 progress? Monty, it's not like we have these people just at our beck and call on speed dial all the time. That's where you come in, Fernando Duarte. Hi, Fernando.
Hello, James.
Hello.
Hello, James.
My word, what a turn up. Here you are, Fernando. How about this Orlando Silva business, eh? Just explain for anyone who's not abreast of latest developments.
Well, basically, James, Orlando Silva has been accused of embezzlement, of actually, you know, siphoning, you know, money from the Ministry of Sports into some ghost projects, like, you know, you put up your own NGO, let's say, to teach poor kids kung fu,
and
you kind of like make fantastic payments, and you disappear with the money. That's basically what he's been accused of, and let's not say he's guilty, but it was enough to make him resign after 12 days of severe, exchange of accusations. He even said that basically the person who is accusing him was actually introduced to him by the former minister, Mr. Agnello Queiroz, who is now the governor of Brasilia, one of the World Cup's host cities.
Right. So tell me, is this something that's going to have an impact on the World Cup preparations? And is it a sign of a gathering storm over the people who are meant to be putting the whole package together?
Well, basically, the demise of Orlando Silva is actually a blessing for the World Cup in a certain way. Because FIFA was really, really ticked off by his whole role in the negotiation. As you might have known, there's a big misunderstanding between the Brazilian government and FIFA and obviously the organizing committee in regards of the legal package for the World Cup, which means the same package that South Africa had to agree with FIFA and Germany as well. Remember, in South Africa, FIFA didn't pay any kind of taxes. There were a lot of like concessions, including the fast courts. Basically, they want to do the same thing in Brazil. And Orlando Silva was supposed to be the person representing the government in the discussions with FIFA. He said, okay, everything's fine. Now I'm going to take the law to the parliament in Brazil, and everything's set up. Basically, the parliament approved something different, and FIFA obviously got very, very ticked off, and Orlando became persona non grata, James.
All right, and now he's gone, coincidentally. That's interesting. In the meantime, Ricardo Teixeira, who's the head of the Brazilian, the CBF, the FA, he's also now potentially in some trouble, or at least that's what people are suspecting, in a long-running corruption case concerning a FIFA-related company. But he still found time to announce the calendar for the 2014 World Cup, and there were one or two controversial bits in there, Fernando.
Yes, very controversial bits. The first thing is that FIFA and the organizing committee decided to release a provisional calendar for the 2013 Confederations Cup. Basically, they want to include some other cities, but they don't know if the stadiums are going to be ready, so they're going to wait until the middle of next year for some of the for two specific cities, Recife and Salvador, to actually, you know, show they can host a competition. Meanwhile, Rio, Fortaleza, Brasília, and Belo Horizonte are the cities chosen to the Confederations Cup. But now for the main event, the World Cup. São Paulo got the opening game, which was pretty much expected, even though their stadium is well behind schedule. They had to build, they just started, actually, their building work. But you could not have the World Cup, you know, one of the important games in Brazil's main city. The problem is, finally Rio de Janeiro, at Maracanã, but this could be the only game Brazil play at home. if the Brazilian national team do not make...
Yeah, yeah, they'll all be at home. The Brazil games will all be at home. It'll be the only game they would actually play in the Maracanã.
Well, only if they make it to the final.
Wow.
The famous Maracanã will only host the Brazilian national team in the World Cup 2014 if they make it to the final. Funny thing is, Brazil will also play in Brasilia,
mm-hmm.
and in Fortaleza. So they created this kind of touring party. Apart from São Paulo, all the other places are like, you know, friendly places that they're not going to boo the national team. In São Paulo, they're going to be booed if they don't score in 2 minutes. So I reckon the committee, the organizers are afraid of putting Brazil in São Paulo and in Rio at the same time. It's tricky.
Quite a lot of concern over here about the distances involved. If you had to make a tip for people who wanted to, say, start booking their trip to Brazil, where would you advise them to go?
Well, Rio de Janeiro is a very easy place, you know, to fly these days. It's going to host 7 games, including the final. It's within very good distance. I mean, it's a 45-minute plane to São Paulo, where the opening is going to be hosted. Another hour to Belo Horizonte, which will also host games. You know, there's no huge distances if you're gonna be based in Rio. Okay, if you want to fly to Manaus, it's something different. But listen, it's a continental country, as we call Brazil. There will be some traveling. Only if you're really unlucky, your team is really unlucky on the draw, that you're going to have to travel a lot. And listen, South Africa, you also had to travel. The problem is not, I think it's not the distance. Some of the roads are terrible. That is the main problem. Ah, if England qualifies, obviously, and they get drawn as the seed of Group C, the top seed, supporters will have to play, you know, to go to 3 landlocked cities. So I think that's going to be a bigger problem than the distance.
Right. All right, Fernando, fantastic stuff. Do keep us up to date on the gently unravelling organisation behind the World Cup 2014, although shame to hear about the silver medalling ending. And look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Can't wait to see you guys.
Yeah, absolutely, Fernando. Fernando Duarte. No singing this time. Let's just finish off then part two. With competition news. Our competition, the trip to see Real Madrid play at the Bernabeu with 2 copies of Pro Evolution Soccer 2012 thrown out by the nice people at Konami. The question was, which international title did Real Madrid win twice in 52 and 56, becoming and remaining the only European side to win this tournament twice? John Ashton, what was the answer?
Oh, it was the Small World Cup.
Yeah, I've never heard it called that before. The Mundialito, I think.
They had to speak Spanish.
No, but the Small World Cup just sounds rubbish. I won the Small World Cup.
Well, it's the Copa del Mundo Pequeña.
Yeah, it's for clubs, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really rubbish title, though, even in Spanish. Anyway, Benjamin Perriman got that right, so he gets the trip. Well done, Benjamin. Very good. All right, well, more top football news coming up in a second or two as we look at the Premier League weekend again. Part three, and we return triumphantly to the Premier League, where there's all sorts of excitement coming up. West Brom taking on Liverpool. Roy Revengela, of course, he's already done the deed to them when Liverpool turned up there in April, and the Baggies had a 2-1 win. Now, Suarez was on form against Stoke in the Carling Cup midweek, but you have to say, West Brom coming on off 2 straight wins, Liverpool off 2 straight draws. Could be another blow to Liverpool's, top four ambitions, this. Yeah.
Yeah, it could be. Liverpool's record away from home isn't particularly good. They've lost against Stoke and Spurs on their travels. And West Brom are, after a start in which they didn't get many points, but I thought they were playing quite well. They had a tough fixtures at the start of the season, and say their first game was against Manchester United. I thought they should have got a point or possibly even won that game. They got nothing. They're high in the hog now after beating Wolves and Villa, their Midlands rivals. So, I wouldn't
know. Shane Long, of course.
No Shane Long, but Simon Cox maybe will play, who's actually done a very good job for Ireland when he's and may have to deputise for Doyle, Keane, and Shane Long against Estonia. So,
is he good?
He is good, yeah. He's a skillful player and uses the ball well and has an eye for goal.
Right.
He's not the same type of player as Long, but he's definitely a threat. And you mentioned Suarez played well during the week, but Andy Carroll did as well. which is probably worth noting because he hasn't done it that often since arriving at Liverpool. Didn't score, no. But he dominated Stoke in the air, which isn't an easy feat. And he showed signs of a developing understanding with Luis Suarez. So it's promising for them.
All right, yeah, that's going to be an interesting game then, isn't it, West Brom-Liverpool? Elsewhere, all sorts of activity at the bottom. Bolton are at Swansea. Blackburn, who are coming off a Carling Cup win, are going to be at Norwich. And Wigan take on Fulham. Wigan haven't won in how long now?
Decades, it feels like, doesn't it?
Yeah, ages.
Wigan are the one team we can probably say at this stage who are we're going to go down. It's hard to pick the three who will be relegated, but they certainly look prime candidates. He talks very well. He dresses very sharply, but I've yet to see that Roberto Martinez can manage a successful team in the top flight.
See, I think you're only saying that because last season you predicted Birmingham would go down really early and you got loads of abuse from their outraged fans, and now you just picked Wigan because they don't have any fans to get upset with you.
Well, no, it's because they've been wretched so far this season, and they weren't great last season. But they do sometimes play nice football, but they don't have someone who can put the ball in the net regularly, and they have a habit of making bad mistakes at the back, and that's a recipe for relegation.
Well, Wigan and Blackburn are the two teams that have only won once so far in the Premier League this season, and it's interesting to note that last year, after 10 games, this weekend's the 10th game in the season. Last year, West Ham were the team that had won 1 in 10. They went down. Right. The year before that, Portsmouth had won 1 of the first 10. They went down.
Yeah.
It's not terminally, it's terminal statistically, but it's not a great place to be, is it?
Blackburn are quite... I wouldn't quite write them off yet, simply because they do have good players to come back. They've got some good defenders who are out, Ryan Nelson, etc. And they have some very good young players who have shown signs of finding their feet in the Premier League, like Rashina and Hoylett. Junior Hoylett has been really good. And although they are very inconsistent, like I saw them at QPR a couple of weeks ago, and they were the worst team I've seen in a long time.
Right.
But they have also put in some very fine performances.
They beat Arsenal.
They beat Arsenal, yeah. A little bit lucky.
Yeah.
And, but apparently they were good against Newcastle last night. I didn't see that. But so they're not doomed yet.
Right. Although Norway has come out against Steve Keane now, so that's got to count for something.
Norway has.
Yeah, the banner at Ewood Park. Norway says no to Keane.
They're big in Norway. I think, I don't know if it's a...
Blackburn.
Yeah. Right. It's a Pedersen thing.
I got pilloried in the Norwegian press last season for saying Morten Gamst Pedersen deserved a smack when punched him in the stomach.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a very nice thing to say, was it, Barry? So, okay, well, Swansea are taking on Bolton, the Pedersen-less Bolton, which looks like trouble for the Trotters, isn't it, really, that one? And Blackburn equally at Norwich. Norwich says no to Keane probably at this point. No? Well, I mean, you know, Norwich are in form, aren't they? And Blackburn aren't.
Well, that would be possibly the one dark cloud on the Norwich horizon would be, will someone eventually come and take Paul Lambert off their hands? Because he's been brilliant since he's got two consecutive promotions, and they're looking really good in the Premier League.
He could become president of Norway if Norway says yes to Lambert.
Yeah, interesting. Now, Sunderland, Barry, taking on Aston Villa. Balbus asks you, Barry, what your thoughts on Niall Quinn being... shafted, according to Balbus, and Agent Bruce still having a job.
I don't want to see anyone lose their job, but obviously if football managers lose their, they get well reimbursed, and loyalty hasn't been a forte of Steve Bruce's in his managerial career to date. But as for whether or not Niall Quinn has been shafted, I don't know, he's been moved to one side, all right.
International development, is that right?
Yeah, I think that's a posh word for making the club big in Asia.
Right.
Sort of thing. But, you know, Quinn, he'll be all right. He's got loads of money. There was talk linking him with Manchester City, Gary Cook's job. I don't think he'll get that. But, you know, neither of them are going to be out of work for too long if they did leave Sunderland.
All right, then. Tottenham are taking on QPR on Sunday. Hey, QPR stand bloody but unbowed over the fallen figure of Chelsea, waving their fist defiantly in the air and saying, Spurs, you're next. in my head anyway.
They won't be. Spurs are looking really good, aren't they? Ever since Scott Parker has arrived in the wake of that home defeat by Manchester City, which is a slightly depleted Spurs side, I think. But a few days after that, they bought Scott Parker, and he's been excellent for them. And he's kind of liberated Modric to just go a-wandering around the pitch and creating. And if you look at the people he has to create for, your Adebayor, Van der Vaart, Lennon, who's back fit again, and Bale. And that's a pretty formidable front five. And Defoe, yeah. So that's a pretty formidable front five.
Right, do you think they'll be all over Rangers then?
I think QPR aren't a good team. Yeah.
No. And then on Monday, Skipper D says, cheers, another non-mention of my team, who the Guardian tipped to be relegated in pre-season, who are fourth and unbeaten. Cheers, Pod, your bus doesn't surprise me anymore. Shame, really. He's a Newcastle fan, Barry.
Well, there's been loads of Newcastle fans complaining about the fact we didn't devote half an hour to their magnificent 1-0 victory over Wigan last weekend. Mm. And they're complaining that we never give Newcastle any mentions of the pod, which is just not true. Besides, we're not obliged to mention every team. And we can mention the fact they got beaten by Blackburn in the Carling Cup last night, which I'd say they weren't expecting. It's the first defeat of the season. They probably had their eye on the Carling Cup as possibly a trophy they might be able to win, and they won't win it now. And, they play Stoke on Monday at
that's
the
a
Britannia.
Tough game. You know what happened last time they went there?
No.
I bet Skipper D does. 4-0 defeat for Newcastle.
Bet Demba Ba will score.
Ah, that's true.
He almost signed for Stoke, didn't he?
Yeah, it was a lovely goal, I have to say. It was a lovely goal against Wigan.
Well, there's probably 50 teams in the Football League we never mention at all, ever. And,
right.
Their fans don't seem to whine so much.
Again, some of them
it goes to this sense of entitlement. You know, the free stuff you're giving us isn't good enough. We want better free stuff. Stop moaning, everyone.
I'm personally always interested to hear feedback from listeners. John, what do you think then? Do you think Newcastle have learned their lesson? Do you think they'll offer a different kind of challenge for Stoke this time around?
Well, they're certainly a better team this year, aren't they? It is an interesting fixture because they're two teams that can justifiably will be challenging for those Europa League places at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they could be the sort of seventh and eighth best teams in the league this season. So outside that big sort of sexy six table that are sort of slightly out on their own, this is kind of like the title clash, isn't it? Is that too much of a build-up for it?
I think Newcastle will win primarily because in midfield, they're much better. Kabay and Tiote. Stoke's centre of midfield is the one area that Tony Pulis hasn't yet addressed as he attempts to develop the team. And they don't have much mobility. They have no creativity. And Newcastle will play through them.
Interesting.
And they defend well, Newcastle.
They do, don't they?
In recent time, over the last year or so, they really do defend well.
Right, okay. Are they good on set pieces, all that kind of thing?
Yeah.
All right, good. Excellent. Well, looking good for you, Skipper D there. That's the Premier League weekend. Of course, we'll have a roundup of it all on Monday in Football Weekly. But that wraps it up for today's Football Weekly Extra. Many thanks to guest producer Pascal, to Barry Glendening, John Ashton and Paul Doyle, and you, the listener. I'll have a paper review up, if you fancy that, on Friday. But have a lovely weekend, and we'll speak to you on Monday.
The Guardian Football Weekly. Sponsored by PES 2012. Forever evolving, forever football, forever Pro Evo.